Well, good morning, everyone. We resume our study of 2 Corinthians, diving right into this text. Hopefully this is oftentimes a conclusion that you make, is that when you study very carefully a biblical text, you come away saying, you come away with a greater appreciation for even the nature of the literature, how it's written, let alone its origin, which is of utmost importance. So we'll be looking at chapter 10 this morning. So you can open up 2 Corinthians chapter 10. So one point we've emphasized about the nature of this book is that it's interconnected to a great extent. A lot of biblical books, certainly narratives, you do this, but even some of the letters, like the letters of Paul, they're linear. You start at the beginning and you understand it by step working through it chronologically, I guess you could say. The book of 2 Corinthians, you need to do that, but you really understand it when you bounce around. When you find something in chapter 2 and you've already read through it, it reminds you of something in chapter 10. You go look at chapter 10, what he says there, it helps to shed light on that statement in chapter 2. And of course, the same thing, you're looking at something in chapter 12 that reminds you of something in chapter 4, and you go and you look at that. And the best way, it's like this book starts glowing. It gets brighter when you bounce back and forth within it. Some biblical books, that would be confusing to do that. But this is, because Paul is referring to so many things that they already know about. And so we have to work through the letter and swim inside the letter to get the full picture of what's going on. So, and what's going on is that Paul, who had been instrumental in these people becoming Christians, now his influence among them is being threatened by pseudo-apostles, as he calls them. Well, we just finished chapters 8 and 9 as a block, and we really took it as a block, and that is his prompting for them to complete their gift to the needy Christians in Judea. Now, starting in chapter 10, really all the way through the beginning of chapter 13, we have another block of material. And it's good to think about it as a block of material. And there is also a little shift in the tone that is subtle until you see it, and it's not so subtle. You know how that is? Something is subtle and then it's pointed out to you and you can't help but to see it then. So it's like that video of the gorilla in the middle of the people throwing the basketball around. You ever seen that? Okay, you see the video and they're throwing the basketball around and somebody says, "Did you see the gorilla?" And you're like, "No." And then they show the video again, and there's a gorilla in the middle of it. It's just, you know, that's what happens here. See David. David's nodding his head. He's seen it, and he can enlighten you on that. But it's like, you know, if you're not looking for something, sometimes you don't see it. Then you start looking for it, and you really see it. So look with me really quick. Glance through this. We're going to scan this. Look in chapter 1, verse 12, and I want you to look for personal pronouns. You know, there are singular pronouns like I and me, and then there's, you know, the group pronouns like we and us, okay, plural pronouns. Look at these verses as I click them off. Chapter 1, verse 12, 2, verse 14, 3, verse 1, 3, verse 12, chapter 4, verse 1, 4, verse 7, 4, 13, 4, 16, and then I'm just going to blaze through it. 5, 1, 5, 6, 5, 11, 5, 16, 6, 1, 7, 1, 7, 5, 7, 13. Okay, I know you didn't keep up with that. What's the personal pronoun you see emphasized? We and us. All right, starting in chapter 10. 10, 1 and 2. 10, 8 and 9. 11, 1, 11, 7, 11, 12, 11, 16, 17, 11, 21, 11, 30, 12, 1, 12, 11. What do you see? I. Now, there are exceptions to this. He'll say I at the beginning of the book. He'll say we and us toward the end of the book. There are exceptions, but you're looking for a pattern. What does that pattern tell you about this section, chapter 10 to 13? It's gotten more personal. What do you mean by this, Earl?
I'm going to catch up with it. He's talking about himself. He talks about himself and his relationship to them as opposed to we.
There are some of those we sections and us sections where it was about Paul and the Corinthians, but it also could be about Paul and Titus and Paul and Timothy and Paul and the apostles and so forth. This is especially personal, this section. So this whole letter is a very personal letter. And now in this very personal letter, we're getting to the real personal part. So watch for that. It's a fascinating letter. So I want to overview this chapters 10 through 12 a little bit, really all the way into the beginning of chapter 13. So what is he doing now in a more personal way? How does this intensify? Well, there were teachers that had come in among the Corinthians discrediting Paul and criticizing him and making accusations about him, unfounded, which was damaging Paul's relationship with these Christians, which was a problem because Paul not only taught them the gospel originally, but Paul as an apostle was continuing to give them the teaching of Christ. And so the problem with these influential people who have inserted themselves between Paul and the Corinthians is they're threatening this pipeline of God's teaching to them. So that's why this is a serious thing, and we'll see that talked about in this section very specifically. But I want to give you some characteristics, an overview of what you could call Paul's rigorous defense. He's already been defending himself. It becomes more rigorous here. It becomes more personal here. So watch how that in detail he defends his ministry. And when Paul's making his defense, as we call it, is Paul just merely defending himself personally, like his feelings and his reputation or something? What is he really doing? Frank, you were... Okay, he does. Sometimes this is thrown off on other people too, yes. Right. So his ministry, his work for Christ, which was vital for these Corinthians, that's really what he's defending. But of course, Paul is tied up with his ministry. You can't separate the two. So that's what's really going on here. So it's his work among them. Also, watch how that, you'll see this at the beginning of chapter 10, he takes his opponents' arguments and even their terminology and he uses it in an ironic way to make a point. He even uses plays on words, okay? Uses a play on words, but he does it multiple times, so we'll call it plays on words. And so watch how he uses that. It's just part of his logic there. He also calls out these pseudo-apostles with very strong language. They're pretending to be, they're claiming to be representatives of Christ when really they're not. They're not legitimate representatives of Christ. And also, there's a greater emotional edge. There's already been an emotional edge. We've seen that in chapter 6 where he talks about open up your heart to me. I've opened my heart to you and so forth. There's even an additional emotional edge here as he talks about some of the things. And watch for this. You'll see this more clearly in the 11th and 12th chapters. There's a paradoxical way in which he presents himself. He has apostolic authority, but he makes frequent references to all the trouble he's gone through and all the pain he's experienced and even bodily his limitations. So, I mean, you think about it, when someone's in a position that we consider to be a power position, they want to present themselves a certain way. I mean, if a mighty politician's at a basketball game, he's still wearing a sport coat. He's still got a blazer. He may not have a tie, but he's got... I mean, there's a way they want to present themselves all the time. You know, when the doctor walks in to examine you, he doesn't walk in a t-shirt and blue jeans and flip-flops, does he? He may want to, but he doesn't. Paul doesn't do that here. Instead of appearing to be some kind of regal authority, he says, I've got these physical limitations. I've been beaten, I've been thrown in prison, I've been shipwrecked. And at a human level, you would think, well, if you're a mighty apostle of Christ, these things shouldn't be happening to you, which is exactly what some of these guys were saying. And we know that because he labors so much to lay his sufferings out. He's using his sufferings as proof that he was an apostle, because who also suffered and actually proved that he was the Christ by his suffering?
Jesus did.
So really what Paul does here by talking about his weak circumstances, and what I mean by that is how he's mistreated and he suffers and he's persecuted and his bodily limitations, actually these are the marks of Christ that he's bearing. So that's an overview. Watch for that in his rigorous defense. Let's look at chapter 10. Let's look at verses 1 through 6. Chapter 10, 1 through 6. Can you read that for us, Elaine? 1 through 6, please.
Now I, Paul, shall urge you by the meekness and gentleness of Christ. I am meek when face-to-face with you, but bold with you when absent. I ask that when I am present, I need not be bold with the confidence with which I propose to be courageous against some who regard us as if we walked according to the flesh. For though we walk in the flesh, we do not war according to the flesh. For the weapons of our warfare are not of the flesh, but divinely powerful for the destruction of fortresses. We are destroying speculations and every lofty thing raised up against the knowledge of God, and we are taking every thought captive to the obedience of Christ. And we are ready to punish all disobedience whenever your obedience is complete.
Great. Thank you. Now, how does he start this section? And in verse 1 and 2, what is he saying regarding how he really wants to address them? What's his preference?
Meek and gentle.
I entreat you by the meekness and gentleness of Christ. And that's how he wants to deal with them. It's like parenting. A parent should want to be kind and tender with the child and only has to be firm when they have to be. When a parent wants to be firm and aggressive and nasty, that's a bad sign. That's right. That's right there. Even though children need to be disciplined, it's not about just throwing your weight around. Paul's got weight to throw around. What he wants to do is entreat them. What does that term imply? Entreat. Your translations may say something else in verse 1. Entreat or what else?
Urge.
Okay. So he's trying to get them to choose to do the right thing and appeal to their, I guess you could say, better motivations. However, he's prepared, as you see in this reading, he's prepared to be what? Bold or strong, firm if he has to be. Now, I want you to look at something here. We're going to jump ahead. Look down in verse 9 and 10. This is that practice of jumping ahead and jumping backwards. Look at verse 9 and 10. We'll read it together in a moment. But if you look at verse 9 and 10, what criticism had these false prophets and false teachers, false apostles, what had they leveled against Paul? Yeah, Joe?
He didn't have a whole lot of presence.
Right.
Basically, I think what they're trying to say.
When he's present with you, he's not very strong and powerful. His letters, are what? They're very weighty. They're heavy. When he writes you, he's got heavy things to say. See what they're doing? They're using his first letter against him. You know, when Paul writes you and he's on the other side of the Aegean Sea, he's pretty aggressive and strong and bold. But when he gets among you, he's just this wimp. You see, even though they're pseudo-apostles, they're employing the thing that Paul addresses in 1 Corinthians 1 and 2, and that is the emphasis of powerful rhetoric. And the Greeks really emphasize that. The ability to get up and speak and persuade people through oratory, that was very important. And what Paul was writing in the first letter is, that's not the most important thing. The most important thing is what you have to say and where the message comes from. And I came to you with the power of God because I had the gospel of Christ. And so the criticism is he's not very powerful in presence, but he is in these letters. Well, look back in chapter 10, verse 1. Do you see the sarcasm? What is it, Earl? Go ahead.
He says, I'm urging you that I can come to you with meekness and gentleness, who am me when face to face, but bold toward you when I'm.
That's me. I'm that guy. I want to be gentle with you, but I'm that guy that I'm bold in the letters, but I'm gentle when I'm there in person. It's sarcastic, is what it is. And when you look down at verse 9 and 10, you see what he's getting at. Yeah.
I love the way he writes, because in Philemon, he does an irony like that. He goes, if I owe you anything, that's why, even though I'm not going to mention that you owe me your very soul. And it's like he put the gun on the spot, and he sure does that.
Yeah, his letters are so well written like that. Yeah. And this is, again, he's taking the accusations against him, and look how he's using them here. Go ahead, Dave.
He starts out talking about the meekness and gentleness of Christ,
right?
Putting that as a forefront.
Does. Yeah, just like it reminds us, doesn't it, of chapter 8, verse 9, when the great motivation for the gift was how Christ gave of himself for us. So always appealing to Christ is the powerful, argument that he uses. Just sort of pushing pause on looking at the text and looking at what's going on here in this relationship. Evidently, though Paul hadn't gotten back over there yet, he'd been hearing what was going on in Corinth, right? It's obvious. He knew about these pseudo-apostles. He knew what they were saying about him. How? I don't think he had listening devices planted. How did he know?
News travels, okay.
So we know from the first letter there are people going between Paul and the Corinthian church, like Titus, possibly some others. We know from the first letter that Chloe's household had visited Paul in Ephesus and told him about things. But that was the earlier letter. I think that's something to think about. I think all of us wrestle with when we learn something, we hear something, what to do with it. Some people can't wait to share it. But based upon sharing it and your motive, that can be slander, that can be gossip, that can be backbiting. We see here, twice in Paul's letters to the Corinthians, there's a place and a time that when you learn about something that you need to share it. What would you say that circumstance was in this situation? Why was it good for Paul to know about this? What these?
The wrong things are being said.
The wrong things are being said, okay? Even really getting in the realm of untrue. So wrong, untrue things being corrected. There we go. There's a good precedent. Well,
really blasphemy when you think about it, because here's Paul as a representative of Jesus Christ, and they're saying he's not. So that's something that completely has to be addressed.
Rebellion against Christ, yeah. Pattern. Okay. Yes. So again, this is putting the Corinthians at risk spiritually. When information is tied to someone's spiritual condition, when using that information and taking and doing something with it is necessary to help them spiritually, that's the difference. And it's not always necessary to share information. And sometimes that's when our motivations of wanting to share a juicy tidbit, gets the better of us. There is a place for sharing information. It's wrong to gossip and backbite and slander. It's also a failure in our relationships if we're not trying to help each other, and sometimes that means sharing information. And some people don't want to cause any trouble, but they don't want to help anybody either. And so Paul's trying to help them. He really is. So, yeah, Joe?
The guy who had things going on with his father's wife.
Right.
The church was aware of that. And Paul certainly came down hard on him.
Right, he did. He sure did.
And these are things of a public nature as well.
Yeah, they are. Yeah, that's another aspect too. Excellent. But of course, Paul wasn't there, but they were public. That's very good. So according to what he's saying here, you know, why does Paul want them to respond positively to this letter? In verses 1-6.
He really cares.
He really cares about them. You see that when he says, I beg you when I am present. I entreat you, those kinds of things. Now, what other criticism do you see in verse 2 that's been leveled at Paul, evidently? We don't know the specifics, but what is said there in verse 2? Some suspect him of what?
Walking according to
Yeah, that's a generic statement. I don't know exactly the details to that. It might be connected to this money thing that Paul is collecting the gift, and some are using that to say he's an embezzler. He's not handling the money properly. You're to suspect him about the money. And that's why Paul goes to great efforts when he talks about the gift in first letter and second letter to say, a team of us are going to deal with this. There are going to be other people involved in this, men that have a good reputation. That might be what he's talking about there. But this gives the opportunity. They're saying of Paul that he's walking according to the flesh. But Paul makes it clear, starting in verse 3 and 4, that though we're in a human body, really his struggle is what? His fight is what? It's spiritual, okay? And he says two things about this warfare. It's funny how he shifts into warfare and uses a lot of military language here. He talks about strongholds. He talks about taking captive, a lot of military-esque language there. And there are two things he says about that. And he says, understand this, that what I'm trying to do, there is a militancy about it, but it's spiritual. And specifically, what does he say about the nature of the warfare? You know, you got hand-to-hand, you got aerial bombardment, you've got artillery. But specifically, what kind of warfare spiritually is he talking about in verse 4 and 5? You're using what?
It's divinely powerful.
It's powerful, and it's divinely powerful. And what are you attacking?
Strongholds.
Strongholds. What kind of strongholds?
Imagination.
People's thinking?
Yes.
Anything that exalts itself.
Anything that's against God? Exactly. Okay? Against the knowledge of God. Look at the language when he says in verse 5, we destroy arguments, lofty opinion, against the knowledge of God, and every thought captive. This is a thinking war. It's about what you see, about what you believe, about what ideology you accept and follow. It's a battle in the mind. And it's a battle with the truth of Christ. By the way, isn't this evidence that when something is called Christian and it involves actual physical or fleshly warfare, it's not Christian? This is one of the marks that tells us, oh, that's not Christian. Because people have, over the last 2,000 years, picked up swords or cannon, and they've claimed that they're doing the work of Christ in that by using swords and cannons and guns and helicopters or whatever. That's not the work of Christ. That's the work of humans. That's human things. That's nations. The battle of Christ, the struggle of Christ, is about what people believe, about knowledge, understanding. It's about truth and falsehood. It's about thinking, every thought captive. That's where the battle is. And it's important to note that. And what's the other thing? Paul says, I'm really fighting a spiritual war. But the other aspect of that is, how does Paul describe himself and his willingness to fight this war? In verse 4, 5, and 6. How would you describe him as a soldier for Christ?
He's all about it.
He's all about it. He's ready. He'll use it. Okay. His opponent said he was what when he was in person? He's what?
Wimpy.
He's wimpy. He's weak. What is he saying?
Strong.
You see, if people think that Paul is not going to be strong and bold, they're going to pay the price on that. They're underestimating him. He may not have the flowery oratory skills of a Greek rhetorist, but he knows how to take the knowledge of God and destroy that which is against God. And if he's got to come to Corinth again and do that, what? He'll do it mightily. That right?
It's not about the flesh, he's saying. It's about the spirit. That's the whole point.
Right. How he comes and presents himself physically and the sound of his voice and his hand gestures and all that, that's not where the power is. The power is in the argumentation. It's in the knowledge. Yeah, Jay?
The beauty of this is that he, with his background, his lens, education, he could do all that.
Yeah.
But he doesn't use that.
Yeah.
He lets his humanness and his dependence on Christ show.
Right.
I love that about him.
Yeah. I mean, and Christ is using the things about his rabbinical training, which helped to sharpen his mind. And boy, does he have a sharp mind. But he engages it for the battle of Christ. Yep, Becca.
I mean, obviously these are Jewish leaders talking about him like this, but they don't even think about the fact that Moses was the same way. I mean, he was a great military leader, but he wasn't a speaker. He himself says so. It's the reason he had to have Aaron as his second.
Moses didn't. By the time he was 80, he felt that way. When he was 40, he was not. Stephen tells us he was mighty in words, but when he was 80, that was not what made Moses powerful. What made Moses powerful is he was on a mission for God. That's what made his work powerful, right? Yeah, Les.
It's helpful sometimes when we, as individual Christians, get into arguments or we're in opposition to something that people, you know, are doing or saying. It's helpful for us to almost say that because it may appear to them that we are their enemy, or that they are our enemy, but it's helpful to say that I'm not your enemy. I'm actually fighting against your enemy, and we're actually fighting. I'm fighting for your soul. You know, I'm fighting against your enemy of yours and mine. And that's the fact that God has an adversary. God has someone who is opposing everything that he is doing. He is opposing his love. He is opposing Christ. He's opposing the morals that God has ordained. I mean, an obvious thing today is marriage. You know, this has been in the news last few days regarding the Respect for Marriage Act and all this kind of thing. But God's design is right. So it's important for us to come across as fighting with them and not against them.
Yeah.
When we're trying to persuade people to be a Christian, to get on God's side, that, you know, tell them, I'm fighting against your enemy. You ought to be on my side.
No, I appreciate that. That's exactly the disposition we should have. Absolutely. Yeah, go ahead.
I had this thought occurred to me earlier, but, you know, Paul's gone through all this stuff. He's been stoned. He's been shipwrecked. He's got an enemy who is trying to thwart everything he's doing. Why wouldn't he be having all these problems?
Right. And it's a great lesson how Paul fights. It's a really great lesson for us. Well, look at verses 7 through 12. 7 through 12. Can you read that for us? Becca, can you read that for us, 7 through 12?
Do you look on things after the outward appearance? If any man trusts to himself that he is Christ, let him of himself think this again, that as he is Christ, even so are we Christ's. For though I should boast somewhat more of our authority, which the Lord hath given us for edification, and not for your destruction. I should not be ashamed, that I may not seem as if I would terrify you by letters. For his letters say they are weighty and powerful, but his bodily presence is weak and his speech contemptible. Let such a one think this, that such as we are in word by letters, then we are absent. Such we will also be indeed when we are present. For we dare not make ourselves of the number, or compare ourselves with some that commend themselves. But they, measuring themselves by themselves and comparing themselves among themselves, are not wise.
All right. So, here Paul gets into the thick of his defense here. What are two things he declares? What does he declare in verse 7? He says, others claiming to be what in verse 7? In Christ, I am too. Okay. What's the other thing that he declares in verse 8?
I can boast about this. I can boast about this.
Okay. And what does he possess in verse 8?
Authority that's actually on there.
He has authority. And this is a reference, direct reference, his apostleship. It is. And he says something very important here. What's the purpose of his apostleship in verse 8? To help them, to build them up, to edify them. I don't have a position of authority because I've earned it or because I'm special and I'm going to occupy this position. You know, humans want position for position's sake. He says, I'm an apostle. I've been chosen to be an apostle. I have this authority as an apostle to help you, to build you up. And it's good to always remind ourselves, in the New Testament, who was an apostle? Not everybody was an apostle. They were all disciples if they followed Jesus. It means a learner. But you only have a select group of apostles. What made them different? What, Joe?
The miracles, the power of miracles.
Okay, they were given the power of miracles. Of course, other Christians also had miraculous spiritual gifts in a limited scale. What'd you say?
They were with Jesus.
Okay. The original 12 were with Jesus and they received direct training from Jesus. They were chosen by Christ for that, okay? They didn't self-appoint, did they? And another qualification, according to Acts 1, they had to be a witness of what? The resurrection, that Jesus was alive. Now, there's a weird exception to the apostles. Clearly, he was a witness that Jesus was alive, but he had not been with the original 12. Who was that? That was Paul. But he was selected by Christ. And we see, based upon Galatians 1 and 2, he was given direct teaching from Christ. So it's like what Peter got, and James and John, etc. And there is a shelf life to apostles. What do I mean by that? There's a shelf life.
They died.
Once they died, there were no more apostles. They were unique. So that's another like red flag. Bing, bing, bing. Somebody says, we've got apostles. Whoa. Can't qualify as an apostle today. And Christ, because he commissioned them like ambassadors, they did have authority. And the authority was in what? They just got together and made up rules? Was that the authority? What were they working from, the apostles? Revelation through the Holy Spirit. They were being given teaching. Remember Paul wrote about arguments and knowledge and thoughts? They were given knowledge and information and teaching and revelation through the Holy Spirit from the Lord. So they were like conduits. They weren't making up the rules. They were catalysts, conduits, pipelines for the revelation of Christ and for the authority of Christ. And Paul says he has authority, but for their benefit, they're building up. Now, think about it. Let's jump ahead. Look over in 11:13. These opponents of Paul, what does he call them in 11:13? What does he say about them in 11:13? False. pseudos, false apostles, okay? They're deceitful, okay? Why would somebody want to act like they're an apostle?
Prestige.
Power.
You turn it into
some kind of gain, personal gain from it. Exactly right. And so that's what's at stake here, is who you're going to let influence you. There are a few things more critical in religion than who you let influence you. I mean, it's nothing compared, you know, other things. Like, you go buy a car, who are you going to listen to? You're going to listen to your next door neighbor, who's your trusted best friend, who's a mechanic. Or are you going to listen to that salesman you've known for 2 minutes? Right? Who are you going to listen to? Who's going to influence you? You know, like, these two guys right here, if they say something about a car, I'm going to listen to them. Or Earl does. Especially if it's pickups. Okay. But, you know, sweet little Lacey here, if she gives me a car recommendation, it's not going to have the same weight. Okay. Now, if Lacey and John tell me something about my golf swing, I'm going to listen to them. And not to Frank and Dave. Of course, I don't play golf, so there you go. But you got the illustration. Got it? So, who are you going to listen to? Who are you going to let influence you? That's what's at stake here in Corinth. And Paul is forcing the issue for them to make a decision here. Not for his benefit, but for their benefit. And remember that criticism, we already mentioned it. And Becca just read it in verse 10. His letters are weighty and strong, but his bodily presence is weak and his speech of no account. Okay? He has two responses to that here immediately after that. What are they? What's the first response in verse 11?
What I say in my letters, I do in person.
He's saying this is a false distinction. Even though he used it sarcastically earlier, he's saying what I am in person is the same that I'm in the letters. He's letting them know that when he comes, don't expect the soft Paul necessarily. It's the same. It's the same message. And what else does he say in verse 12? When they're saying he's like this and he's like that. Yeah.
He doesn't compare himself to anything human.
It's a false comparison. So you're using the wrong standard.
His standard is Christ.
Right. He's saying that don't get pulled into an analysis on the wrong basis. These opponents of his, they're really, what's their standard of measurement? Each other. They're comparing themselves to themselves, okay? So if I've never heard Rick play the guitar and I pick up a guitar and I start doing like Smoke on the Water or something like that, I think, wow, I'm really good. And then I listen to Rick, and I'm like, I don't even look at a guitar again. I mean, that kind of thing. There's no comparison. They're comparing themselves with themselves. They have established a standard for what is a faithful worker of Christ. They've established a standard for who's the messengers of Christ. And guess what? They meet it. Duh. Why do they meet it? They set the standard. They set the standard, so no wonder. So no wonder Paul doesn't meet their standard. No wonder they're criticizing Paul, that he doesn't meet their standard. But guess what? Their standard is not what matters. They've got the wrong standard. And, you know, like someone said, Christ is the standard. And that's what's wrong with, you know, commending yourself with yourself. And I'm doing a really good job. Who you're looking at? But when you look at Christ, that's a whole different analysis, a whole different evaluation, isn't it? All right, let's look at this last section here real quickly. Ray Conies, can you read verses 13? I'm sorry, I caught you off guard. Les, can you read 13 to 18?
It's okay. You were not even supposed to be in this class. I'm picking on you, sorry.
13 to 18, Les.
Okay. We, however, will not boast beyond measure, though within the limits of the sphere of which God appointed us, a sphere which especially includes you. We are not overextended. For we are not overextending ourselves as though our authority did not extend to you, For it was to you that we came with the gospel of Christ, not boasting of things beyond measure, that is, in other men's labors, but having hope that as your faith is increased, we shall be greatly enlarged by you in our spirit. To preach the gospel in the regions beyond you, and not to boast in other man's sphere of accomplishment, but he who glorifies, but he who glories, let him glory in the Lord. For not he who commends himself is approved, but whom the Lord commends.
All right, thank you. Now, what's the basis of Paul's influence with these people, these Corinthians? What had he done? He brought them the gospel. Verse 14, we were the first to come all the way to you with the gospel. And what was his hope for them, starting in verse 15? His hope was what? That as they matured and got stronger in the faith, what did he hope? That his influence with them would increase because they would understand how he could help them. And there's something else. He hoped also that as they grew and mature under the influence of Paul, that what could Paul do? That as they matured, he could do what? Move on somewhere else and teach somebody else. Now, he's not in Corinth right now. But ever since he's left Corinth, what has he had to do? Deal with their issues. Great way to put it, Rick. Deal with their issues. Paul's going to help them. He loves them. But he's having to deal with them. He's having to write letters. And we're grateful that he has. It's all in the providence of God. He's having to plan these return trips and so forth. If they would have been more mature in all this, things could be down the road further and he could be helping other people. And I think it's a statement of, you know, a little rebuke here, or strong rebuke of their immaturity, again, that pops up, which we saw in the first letter. And in verse 18, evidently in verse 18, we've already seen this from the earlier section, the opponents, the pseudo-apostles, their commendation was based upon what they thought, their own themselves. But what does Paul say in verse 18 about what commendation is about? The Lord's commendation. And he's laid out here why he should have influence with them, okay? And why the Lord's commendation is with him is because he's been carrying the Lord's message. They are proof that he was carrying the true gospel. Their salvation, their conversion is proof that he had the message of Jesus Christ of salvation. The evidence is right there in front of you who you should be listening to. I've brought you the gospel. You see the proof of the gospel. You see the power of the gospel. The Lord's commending me to you to help you, not to rule you and not to dominate you. That's a human thing. But this is my role to help you. You got to let me do that. That's what he's telling them in this letter. He really loves these people. But he's going to do what God wants him to do, and he's going to do it the Lord's way. And he's committed to that. Okay, thank you very much. We'll dive into chapter 11. Our plan is Wednesday night, Lord willing.